Hello.
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 Hello, man. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well.
Okay.
It's Tuesday.
Hey, am I right? How are you guys doing? Joe, are you working late? Do you work late these days?
Well, I'm not working late this particular day. I had been working late last month, and I will be working late this upcoming month. But it fluctuates.
He's got a lot of VFX to make.
Yeah.
All for the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The greater good. I didn't make it through all of the last episode.
That's fine.
You turned it off.
I turned it off.
It was expected.
It was very upsetting. I had to turn it off.
We were going to probably save for the end so we don't spoil anything for anyone, but we could have a segment at the end of the show where you berate us about Baby Driver.
No, yeah. No. I'm not the internet. I'm your pal Merlin.
Well, you know, yeah, you have input, and whether if you would like to give it to us, then...
You guys are industry professionals. I don't get a vote on this.
Is that industry professional? My microphone is balancing on an ironing board right now.
Nice. Do you use it for ironing, too?
It's not mine. I'm not at my home because my home is currently 90-something degrees.
Oh, no.
So there's that.
Yeah. Unfortunate AC situation.
That sucks.
Yeah.
See, now my promotional graphic that I made, I have to tell you, I was on my MacBook Adorable, where I have the image editing program called Preview is what I had. So I had to do that. I had to do that fake drop shadow, whole nine.
Did you do it with CSS? I hear you can do that with CSS.
Oh, I do all of my effects with CSS. It's called the Cascade. It's a Cascade.
No, that was good. That was a nice composite, as they call it in the industry.
I cropped it and everything. It's not flopped. It's cropped.
I greatly appreciate the attention to detail with the Mistral.
Oh, yeah. I spent about half my day reading about Mistral.
That's important research.
It's got a... It, you know, I sent y'all in our private messaging channel. I sent you a screen grab of the Wikipedia page for Mistral, and it really, that is a good and 80s font.
Yep. Even though it was much earlier than that, I was actually surprised by the early Tuesdays.
63, something like that.
Yeah.
But you got, and boy, what a diverse, disambiguate. Oh, come on. Ugh. What is wrong with you, Jimmy Wales? Put Mistral up top. No, I don't mean wind. I mean Mistral typeface. 1955, they made Mistral. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I mean, it looks so 80s. They were really 30 years ahead of their time.
It's so strange how certain typefaces are just so evocative. And I'm no John Gruber. Like, I can't tell lots of... I'm one of those people that I can't legit tell Helvetica from the other one, Arial. I cannot tell it as well as I'm supposed to for my nerd bona fides, but I do have a very strong emotional response to certain typefaces, and I will admit that I am a diva in that I will flip the bozo bit on certain fonts. Typefaces.
Like Papyrus or...
See, it used to be, it was funny to always use Comic Sans when you wanted to say, ha ha, I know what dumb fonts are. I cannot believe how many people still use Papyrus for anything that they want to look fancy. It's like the official, like, you know, Ramada in Spa font, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's most of the dermatologists or nail salons around here that are trying to have a nice desert theme or something.
Scirocco.
Yeah,
extensively.
The one amazing thing about Arizona is basically everybody has Papyrus and Cocopelli everywhere.
Cocopelli.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They just opened the name is literally Cocopelli Dentistry right down the street from us.
Wow, they must be great dentists.
No. I mean, they're in a strip mall next to a Supercut, so, you know, it's...
Cocopelli font.
Oh no! It's just the little dancing guy, the little Native American dancing guy.
Oh, is he the fertility symbol? Isn't he a fertility man?
I feel like there are multiple. They're usually playing some sort of flute or something, I think.
Cocopelli Chill. Let's do a little bit of reading the internet, shall we?
Oh, good.
Cocopelli. It's a fertility. Well, as you know, it's a fertility on the internet science site. Cocopelli is a fertility deity, usually depicted as a humpback flute player. That's pretty retrograde. Often with feathers or antenna-like protrusions on his head, who has been venerated by some Native American cultures. Oh, in the southwestern U.S.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why Dan has one on a screen door.
Is that right?
No, it came with the house, and I didn't have an angle grinder or any touch-up paint, so I left it. So, yes, there is a Cocopelli on my security screen door.
You have a very fertile door.
Well, here's what you need to know from the Internet Science site. Cocopelli presides over both childbirth and agriculture. He's also a trickster god and represents the spirit of music.
Music, agriculture, and childbirth. That's a pretty solid resume right there, I suppose.
I wonder how you get from hunchback with the flute to, you know, busting a nut. That's pretty.
He's like Pied Piper, but he's got a different flute for a different thing. He's got a different day of the week.
Except these professional women in their late 30s follow him around. Anyways, so you got 1983 was used for the title of the movie Flashdance, Mistral. Night Court, look at that, Silk Stockings, NWA on their Straight Outta Compton album. Goosebumps.
Sandals. That one's my favorite.
So Sandals, is that like a discount resort? It's one of those all-in-ones, right?
It's one of those all-inclusive ones. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And mostly in the Caribbean, I think. And I think there are different levels. I was corrected on this once upon a time because I thought they were all basically the same, but apparently there are different tiers of the all-inclusives. I've only been to one all-inclusive for someone's wedding, and I would not go back to that particular all-inclusive. I don't really think it's for me. There's just something about the not exchanging money for goods and services thing that kind of makes all the goods and services kind of just a little not great.
Well, it's a little bit like crashing on your friend's couch where you really don't feel like you're in a position to ask for anything, you know? And I always feel like for me to succeed at a vacation, I have to go to the same place twice. The first time I go anywhere is always a practice run, and it's usually a total shit show. And then eventually, like, if I go a second time, I'm like, now I know. Like, you know, I went to one of these in... where was it? In one of those Caribbean countries. I went with a company and all inclusive. And it's, you know, it's if you like drinking beer in the sun, like if you're like a real like, you know, real like if you're a German and you're ready to tan, you know, it can be a good gig. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it seemed to be a lot of, well, I would say mainly a lot of people from America, actually, in this particular case. But yeah, mostly just people were like, yeah, give me a whole thing of Absolut on ice, and I'm just going to drink that out here in the sun. It's like, all right, have fun.
Did you have one of those places where you can be drunk in a pool, and there's a bar that'll accommodate people who are drunk in a pool? You walk up to like a pool bar, drunk in a pool?
Yeah.
Did it have that kind of thing?
Yeah, there was also a bar in the pool or at the pool edge, yeah.
Yeah, I don't see... I don't know if that's such a good idea.
No. But, you know, these kinds of vacations and experiences are the things that Ryan Gosling's character in Drive could never experience because...
Nice. Wow, that was good. That was good. Is that called compositing? What was that?
They call that an ad merge. Good work, Joe.
Yeah. That's called a left join.
Yes.
Yeah, your lens flare is a little too bright. We can see it. It's too noticeable.
Sorry, I'll screen that on. But
if you can see the light wrap, it's too much light wrap. I heard that on the internet somewhere.
Yeah well, it reduced like it by 50% afterwards. Pay attention to those camera smudges in the order of operations about motion blur.
Oh, come on, seriously. If you're going to splatter on the lens and then have some jiggle in the lens, Todd has a whole story fi about this. You've probably seen it.
Yeah. By the way, I've never been to an all-inclusive resort, but my Twitter bio now says German and ready to tan because that is awesome.
I realize I've already said a lot of very problematic things tonight. You're going to have to cut a lot of them out. But yeah.
No, you get a pass. We're allowing those.
No, I wish that were so. The Germans get real oily. They'll be real kind of big with real minimal swimsuits and then a big thermos of some kind of a frosty beverage they enjoy. Stein, I think it's called.
I'm glad you recognized that you had said some problematic things and then yeah. veered hard into that. That worked out.
The Germans are proud. They're a proud people. They're very organized, and they're good with bookkeeping.
Uh-huh. I don't want to dig this hole any deeper, but I did just meet some Germans who were here for work, and they were at the bar because the airline lost their bags for 2 days.
Ach du lieber.
So there were this group of very confused-looking men wearing just, like, I Heart America and giant American flags and, like, local high school T-shirts. I'm like, what's going on over here? And they just looked at me like they were scared animals because they had no idea what I was saying. But they were they're test drivers for Mercedes-Benz. They were dropped in the middle of the desert to go to a test track and drive around for a week and then fly back to Germany. But the only place that was open at night is this really horrible fake Irish bar. And I talked to one of the fellows about what he likes about Stuttgart for an hour and a half.
Beautiful fine furniture. And way to bring it back around to driving. Well done, Dan.
Yeah. They were very technical, very specific. They give notes about the vehicles. It's important that it look a certain way and perform a certain way.
And yeah, a lot of them wear those CGP gray glasses. You ever notice that? They like have a CGP gray frame.
Does he have a face? Does he wear glasses?
He has a kind of face. He has a coffee cup and he points. But the German, a German will take a CGP gray frame and then you drop in some sweet Robert Evans like tinted. Lenses.
Oh, I wish I could pull off the lenses like a tinted purple or like a blue
purple
or something
or a yellow like an Ardown Jr. kind of situation. Like somebody
you don't want to look like you're hunting foxes or something, but you want to have a little bit of a hue there to make sure you stand out.
No, the kind of guy who has a white van and wants your kid to help find a puppy. You know, like
maybe he's chewing on a toothpick, not in a creepy way.
No. You can give a kid a toothpick, which reminds me of the recent movie. Drive
from 2011. Is that the movie Drive you're talking about?
Is that the one? Is that the one?
Yes.
We've dove in a little bit, somewhat deep with this, but like, I think. Can I take over your show for a minute?
Sure,
absolutely.
How's it going, guys? It's been a big week, and so I was real mad at Joe in particular because he's a monster. I love the movie Baby Driver, but I accept this is something that now I think between Syracuse and Todd and me, we have decided that this is what I've been searching for a term for this for like 2 years. What do we call that kind of piece of media? We were like, look, just give me this, right? Like for me, that's The Smiths. I understand why you don't like The Smiths, but I like The Smiths, but I'm calling that a gimme. Just give me this one. And so like for me, I feel like Baby Driver is a little bit, I know it's a popular movie, but I think it also, as we heard in your program that I heard part of, people have very strong feelings. And I think there are not that many people that were like, C+. I think people were pretty mostly into it or were like, I just cannot buy into the Baby Driver world. Have you gotten any vibe of that from people?
Mainly, I have received feedback that I didn't love the movie enough. But only from a few people.
But when you hear other people talking about it, I mean, it seems like most people I know really, really liked it. And a lot of people were like, ugh, especially for an Edgar Wright movie. That was a dumb movie that I just couldn't, you know, again, like another one you guys did, La La Land. Like you buy into that or you don't, right? I mean, there aren't that many people that are like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like you could even say like, oh, I like this song, but not that song. But in general, it's like if you don't buy in, if you're not into that movie by the time he's walking down the street to Harlem Shuffle while lyrics from the song are appearing on graffiti and in conversations, you are not going to like that movie.
Well, but see, this is the hard part because I did actually like the movie. I just didn't love the movie. And
yeah,
so
the worst.
That's the worst kind.
That's, you get the most criticism for that. Well, I didn't hate it.
No. But see, I think that's the problem though, is that I was not completely put off by everything in the film and, you know, reject the film. I still thought it was fun and I did not regret the use of my time seeing the picture. And I ranked it above some other Edgar Wright films. You might not have actually heard that part because you threw your iPod across the room in rage. But
you definitely won't be infuriated when we actually stack rank Edgar Wright's films at the end of that podcast.
Yes.
Oh, you did that? You did that.
Joe did it voluntarily. I didn't even have to drag it out of him.
Oh, sure. Just throw me under the bus. But
Shut up. I didn't do it. Probably did it too. I don't remember.
I would love to I should go back and listen to that program.
No, I don't think so. I think your blood
pressure
probably.
Are Dan and I the only ones
that
worship at the altar of Hot Fuzz? Where's your standing on Hot Fuzz?
Oh no, Hot Fuzz is my favorite Edgar Wright movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about you, Dan? What's your favorite?
Yeah, I think Hot Fuzz is probably number one. I mean, I really appreciate World's End for, I mean, the extreme attention to detail. You went down that rabbit hole back when that was, you know, still kind of new, and every little bit of every little scene and every location is tied into the story in some way, and it's just so expertly crafted that you have to appreciate it on that level.
Right.
So it's super enjoyable.
I think that drives some. Whereas I find that very satisfying. I mean, I like stuff that rewards me for watching closely because I tend to not watch things closely. So there's a handful of things that when I watch it, I really, really, really watch it. And I can see how somebody will go, oh, that is just too cute. Oh, the mermaids and, oh, you know, marmalade sandwich. And like, oh, it's just too much. And, you know, my friend Max likes to give me a hard time about the aliens at the end. I know. But like, you know, that's the thing with him is that you can tell. And we'll probably come around in a second to explaining why this is germane to Edgar Wright and the history of driver movies. But I like a movie where somebody has clearly, like, really, I guess an extreme example might be Mad Max Fury Road, that the stories that I've heard were that the director had essentially like kind of mental storyboards for that, but there wasn't very much on the actual page. Right. Isn't that kind of the story with Fury Road? But he had a clear like storyboard, almost like Jodorowsky Dune, kind of like, I know what every shot in this movie is going to look like.
That's my understanding as well. Although yeah. I am not fully versed in all of the behind the scenes content that is available for one to consume.
Well, as long as I'm derailing, yeah. though, have you seen the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune?
No, because everybody says it's amazing and I want to save it for a special day.
Save it for prison. Also directed by the man whose name I will not even attempt to pronounce, who did the movie Drive. He directed that documentary.
I did not know that.
I just found this out yesterday.
And I think it's Nicholas Winding Refn. But
oh, God. That was good.
Sure. I'm not sure.
So some of the folks across the pond say Winding Refn, but as far as the various interviews and things that I've seen, is Winding Refn.
No, yeah. Well, every day is a Winding Refn.
Mm-hmm. Sitting right, outside right. Car wash Tuesday.
Can we cut him out of the conversation now?
Yeah. Well, okay. So here's the thing: is that I was, as I've mentioned elsewhere, this is one of my pretty rare instances of what our friend Todd calls full media blackout, where I went into this with like, okay, this is my first Edgar Wright movie. Oh, sorry. I swear to God, this is going somewhere. The Baby Driver was a movie that I was just excited about on the face because I have become, just irrationally into Edgar Wright and his whole deal and like listening to his commentaries on things. One nice thing about The World's End, if you get the stupid Blu-ray, is there's many different commentaries. There's like three or four different commentaries with like the writers, the effects people, the director, et cetera, et cetera. But, but in hearing, so I went into the full media blackout. I really liked it. But then of course, afterwards, that's when I started digging into the interviews. And I guess I was not aware of this, small, but very related genre of movies about getaway drivers. And I'd seen Drive and really liked it. I own it. I've seen it probably 4.5 times now. But like, I wasn't aware that there's like this, you know, this tradition of this certain kind of laconic character, and that Drive and Baby Driver were both heavily influenced by a movie I'd never heard of called The Driver from 1978. And so that set me back down this rabbit hole. And that's how I ended up, you know, getting excited to talk about this with you guys. And I'm going to send you a Shamazdat copy of that's 1978 movie, because I think you might really like that too. But it's very much this like crazy car chases, laconic driver who's like not upset by much of anything, a loner with, you know, a strange or not much of a past. And I don't know, it has been an unlikely genre that's really, I've really turned on to in the last few months.
Hmm. While we're talking about commentaries, before I forget, I've said it numerous times on this show, but the Hot Fuzz commentary that he does with Tarantino, it was like a special edition Blu-ray. It's in my Huff Duffer. I've listened to that so many times. They don't even talk about Hot Fuzz, really. They just talk for 2.5 hours about hundreds of different movies that they love and all of their influences. It's a great commentary.
Oh, I would love to hear. It's on Huff Duffer.
Yeah, it's on mine somewhere. I'll find a link for you.
Okay. Yeah, I would love that.
But this movie in particular, when we're talking about the driver character, I don't think we should or can really stack this up against Baby Driver in terms of character, but this one very much feels more like it's in line with those previous types of genre films, where you've got your stoic, violent when necessary, but, you know, kind of breaking the law character. Whereas, I mean, I feel like Baby Driver, he was so backed into that situation you know, by nature of being blackmailed by Kevin Spacey, sort of, that he didn't really embody that character so much to, that a lot of it was just sort of he's doing the things that he has to do. And then I was really missing the emotion driving the characters, whereas this movie is, 98% emotion driving literally everything that happens in this movie. And I think that's why it works so well. It's, you know, those completely self-indulgent, super slow-mo scenes and shots and really drawn out responses and conversations between people. It's all about the, you know, the nonverbal and the emotional connection between these people. And you can feel it viscerally so distinctly and exactly the way they wanted to lay it out in this movie and, you know, get you on the emotional journey that this crazy director wanted you to take. And it just works so well. Like, there's so many things about this movie that are like broken and missing. Like, there's continuity breaks. There's stuff that I, as a visual effects artist, I go like, oh, I can see your camera in that reflection. And I really want to paint that out, but I don't care because this movie is so perfect. It just, I totally excuse all of it.
Yeah. The, I mean, the one thread that runs through this where admittedly Baby Driver falls a little short just because it chose to focus on other things is in a movie like The Driver or like this or any of these other movies that I would call an overused term, but anti-hero movies where there's somebody who's, you know, maybe not a particularly great person. They have some kind of a past, but, you know, there's that trope of like, okay, and now they have a reason to want to get out of the business. And yeah, maybe it's a girl or maybe it's Benicio or whatever it is. It's just that with Baby Driver, which I loved, I mean, I think they sacrificed some of that depth of feeling because basically a waitress sings a song with his name in it and he sees her walking around. You go, okay, well, that's economical storytelling. I can buy in on that. Yeah. But in this case, I don't get too far ahead, but like one of my favorite things in this is just Ryan Gosling's, I love how patient this movie is at points and how long it'll linger on a shot that anybody else would want to blaze through. And you just kind of drink in the way this thing is lit and the way it's framed. And like how many directors would have the courage to just have a shot of an adult actor and a child actor just looking at each other where it doesn't end with breaking down into laughter? Like where like there's not, you know what I mean? There's a, maybe it's affection, maybe it's curiosity, but there's something about it that like letting that be on camera a little longer with, in this case, the lady from Blink watching, like, I think that's very effective. And, you know, certainly his emotions about what is happening are very complicated, but he does not portray that in action until he's ready to do like a specific thing about it. And I thought that was really effective in Drive.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, there's the opportunities for, you know, with his blank expression for the audience to project whatever they feel like should be happening at any given time, which is useful. But it's also, you know, his incredible subtlety really draws you into noticing the small changes in this rather stoic character. So when you do see those, like the violent outburst and the shaking when he's holding the hammer, it's like, oh, okay, so this guy's clearly been pushed beyond a point that he doesn't typically want to go beyond because, you know, for all intents and purposes, we assume he knows what he's capable of because he's done it before, but he really doesn't want to be that guy. And he's got this little whiff of the life he could potentially have. But he, you know, at the end of the story, he realizes that he can't actually have that because that's not for him.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love everything about this movie, basically.
I mean, I was so worried that Joe in particular would hate it because I feel like I'll tell you why. He sighs a lot, but also because I feel... I'm not even going to call this a gimme because I think this is actually a very good movie. It is that I feel like it's if there's a movie that I don't like or didn't get into or didn't buy into, and somebody's explanation for why they like it is, oh, it's an exercise in style or it's a meta, you know, narrative. You know, you can think about all kinds of like whatever, whether that's, you know, Kenneth Anger to a certain extent, maybe even, you know, Robert Altman, some Stanley Kubrick, probably. There's all kinds of stuff where you go like, oh, if you're a movie fan or you're a fan of what this is about without saying it's about, you'll really like it. And the way that, oh, this is a nod to this and that. And it's like, yeah, okay. Like I'm not a sophomore in college. Like tell me a good story. Well, but, so I was worried that I would have to pull out the, oh, I like this because it's stylish card. But in watching it again, I do feel like it's passes that Ebert sniff test of like, I feel like I knew I got what this fellow was trying to accomplish with his team. And I think he did a really good job of accomplishing that really fairly fearlessly in almost every way.
I agree. And to allay everyone's fears who's listening, who was not privy to other conversations, I actually liked the film. So that no one sent me angry letters yet, but I was a little concerned because I had seen another project by this director that he did after this called Neon Demon, and it was horrendous. And I wasn't sure if I
is that
wanted
the super duper colorful one.
Is
it the really weird one?
Yes. Super duper colorful, super weird. There's also a character in Los Angeles who's transformed over the course of the picture, much as there is a character who goes through a transformation in Drive, but this is a good movie, and the other one is horrible. I don't know where exactly these things have diverged, but
it looks very stylish, Joe.
Oh, it's really beautiful. But this film manages to pull off looking stylish and having something to say. There are some times where they're lingering on some shots, and I'm like, okay, yes, we get it. He has a scorpion on the back of his jacket. I understand.
There's points where it's a little bit campy, and you're not sure if it was meant to be that campy.
Yeah, and the sort of affectation that they provided for Ryan Gosling, or that Ryan Gosling invented and proposed to the director, I'm not sure, of his long, drawn-out pauses where he doesn't seem to be responding to the person who's talking to him until several seconds have elapsed. I found that interesting as well. At first, it was kind of frustrating, and I was like, is this an editorial mistake? But they do it in these two shots. In these medium shots with the two actors in the same frame. So it's not that the editor slipped or something and included extra frames on accident. It was a very purposeful thing to include that extra time elapsing in between the end of whatever question or statement had been offered to him and whatever his response would be. But it was definitely a pattern throughout the film. But these are like minor quibbles. Like I really enjoyed it. I thought they did a good job. It seemed, if not necessarily realistic, at least consistent with the world that it had built for itself through the course of the picture. I didn't feel like anyone's motivations were unbelievable at any point from the start of the picture to the end. And that even goes for our villains, who are not entirely obvious as villains at the start of the picture, even though, well, let's just say, by the time we got to the car racing scene and there was the handshaking and stuff, it's like, oh, Albert Brooks is gonna cause some problems. There's gonna be some issues with him, and sure enough, there were. Even these villains who are in the picture are consistent with the stuff that happens throughout the course of things, and you have a love story in here that is pulled off, I think, pretty effectively. In that we go from an affair that is sort of a mild flirtation to this sort of resignation that he's going to help them in some way, this other couple that he can never be part of, to the mourning and the shock of having participated in the destruction of that family, and how he can never be a part of that. That he, in an effort to help, has sabotaged everything. So I like all of these things that are in there. I don't think this movie is just superficial. Dan,
I agree. I don't know where he goes. I mean, yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I love about this movie that upon rewatching you sort of get the feel for is like, it also again is one of those movies that it works as a movie more than it does as reality, because I love the opening scene, not the opening scene in the hotel where he's talking on the phone, which sort of where he lays his ground rules, which is a good scene. But I like the scene where he goes and meets up with Shannon to get his car, because if this is the first time you've seen the movie, that interaction with Shannon seems perfectly normal. But if you watch it a second time, you're like, wait a minute, why is Bryan Cranston talking to him like he's just met him for the first time? He's like, you know, you look like you haven't slept. Can I offer you some stuff? Oh, that's right, you don't smoke. I forgot about that. And here's the car that you asked for. It's like, do we really believe that they haven't had this conversation more than once, like in the weeks running up to this job or whatever?
He's a sweet talker. I think Shannon is a keening sort of like striving sweet talker who's maybe not super bright, but I think he nails the role pretty well in a couple ways. But yeah, I agree with you. The other thing with the, we should talk about this cast, because this is really a heck of a cast. But one thing with the two primary antagonists, Bernie and Nino, is in some ways, you know, on the face of it, they do almost seem like cardboard cutout baddies. But on another level, they're just incredibly practical. And you know what I mean? Like I like a baddie who's a baddie because it's about the business. And I don't think it's beyond that. They don't necessarily take any joy in being cruel, but that I like that there was not a giant pause, for example, before that horrible, there's so many horrible scenes in this, the scene with Shannon, where he just goes, that's it. It's okay. It's almost over. It's almost over. And there's, it was very neutral. It was, you know, he's very neutral about it. It wasn't, he was not trying to make it hard on the guy, but he was also not going to be monologuing about what it means to betray me and stuff like that. That really was just business. And this is the, you know, I don't like evicting people from their house, but that's what I have to do. I have to have people who pay the rent. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, sometimes with a baddie, it helps to understand like what their motivation is. And in these cases, the motivation is business and then suspicion of the way that my business might be met with or might be screwed with. And where I have got to take precautions to make sure that this problem gets taken care of before it even becomes a problem. And if anybody around me is careless enough to let something become my problem, like you forget the egg rolls and you're going to hear about it. Like as Al Swearengen says, I have to deal with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a mob movie in the sense that it's not one of those mob movies where one character says like, I don't like the way we're running things like we did back in the old days. I'm going to be the new head of the family and I'm going to stir things up. It's like, well, no, he states outright, you know, the money flows up. It always has. And these are the rules of the things like the side jobs you have in between doing family business. That's fine. But if that gets in the way, there are consequences and there are rules. And it's like, you know, he sighs deeply and Shannon's kind of a friend of his. He liked him, but it's like, you know what? This is the consequence. And we have to execute the policy. Like, you know, the army works because people follow orders. It's the kind of thing that is built on, you know, these are the rules. You got to do this sort of thing. And even if you don't like it, and otherwise the whole thing falls apart. And that's
right. And like the way that Bernie understands motivation and power in a way that sweet talking Shannon, I guess kind of doesn't. So like the entire thing with the getting the race car, like Shannon's just looking for another thing for him. But maybe this is the thing that could be his ticket out. And the thing is, Bernie knows now he's got him on the hook. He understands his motivation. But then once he's got him on the hook, you know, then he's able to say like, you know, it's going to be this amount instead of that amount, and I'm going to own most of it. So Shannon may feel like I still don't completely understand why Bernie did that. But I guess why do you think he wanted to do the car?
I'm not entirely sure. I don't think it's not. Bernie wasn't going to go legit, but in that scene right before he kills Shannon, he talks about how nice it would have been to have his name on the car racing around.
Right.
There seems to be some element of vanity to it, not necessarily practicality in that particular case with the car.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have to imagine that owning the car lets them control the mechanic and driver who have already been working for them. So, you know, if this doesn't pan out and they still owe 70%, well, they're still going to go back to going to do all the jobs that I wanted them to do to pay me off.
And you get a Goodfellas type situation where, I mean, you could probably always use another source for laundering money one way or another.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Like, they just stuff it full of money and, oh, it came in last place because it's so weighed down. Who could have
anticipated? It's my passion project.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, plus I think they do a great job of, you know, sort of explaining that in, not like literally explaining it, when he has that conversation with Ryan Gosling at the shop. He says, you know, we're going to be ready for our first race. And he's like, look, don't give me the false modesty thing. But basically what he's saying is like, whether you understand it or not, Shannon is now on my hook and so are you. So mm-hmm. if this goes badly, it's bad for both of you. And I like Shannon, and he's done some things like this before and it didn't really work out. And now he's got this goofy leg brace on. So it could go very bad for both of you. So let's make sure this goes well. In a roundabout way, he's basically saying, I own you. So let's all have some fun and make some money.
Right.
And Nino, I would contrast that, Ron Perlman's character. He's practical in a sense, but he's also, ambitious. In that
and paranoid.
And paranoid, yes. Yeah. And while Bernie's more calculating and shrewd about things, he doesn't want to waste resources, etc. Nino is a little sloppier, I would say. Mm-hmm. Especially when you get to that scene with Nino, Cook, and Bernie, where they're debating what to do about the people who have witnessed these things, who have knowledge about Nino's power grab with the money, and how they need to make that all go away. And so, well, you're going to make me make Shannon and Ryan Gosling go away. Well, mm-hmm. then I'm going to make, you know, Cook go away. He's another person who's seen this too. So that is quite a brutal scene, but it's something where Nino hadn't even thought of getting rid of Cook. That he wasn't really thinking as pragmatically as Bernie was.
Mm-hmm. What a cast.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. People have strong feelings about Ryan Gosling. I like him a lot. Carey Mulligan, I think, is tremendous. I mainly know her from being in my all-time favorite episode of the Doctor Who TV show. Bryan Cranston, total pro. Albert Brooks, not playing it for laughs. Oscar Isaac, small role, but like this is like from around the time of like, wait, when did Oscar Isaac first show up on the scene? What was his first? I feel like it was sort of like an Ed Norton. Wait, Ed Norton? Is that the guy? Is that the guy from The Honeymooners or the guy from the movies? Who am I thinking of? Who's the guy from Fight Club? What's his name?
That's Ed Norton.
Ed Norton. Okay, well, who's Jackie Gleason's neighbor? What's his name?
There's a Norton in there.
Norton. Edward Norton. Edward Norton. It's kind of like the Edward Norton year, where all of a sudden there's this guy who comes out of nowhere, and you're like, my God, where has this guy been? He was in the Coen Brothers movie. He was in, what do I know him from?
He popped out of nowhere so fast they couldn't even get a shirt that actually fit him for this movie.
he was in Ex Machina.
This is from his year. He was in Sucker Punch and Drive in 2011, I think. So this might have been the first thing I ever saw him in.
I think it was the first thing I saw him in.
Llewyn Davis is 2013. Ex Machina is 15. Star Wars, X-Men Apocalypse. Yeah. So this would probably be one of the first things I ever saw him in.
Oh boy, that X-Men movie.
Oh boy.
Save that for another trip.
Have me back.
Speaking of the cast, I don't remember where I read it, but you know the scene where Nino goes to the beach? If you watch that real close, I don't know if you saw this trivia anywhere. I didn't see it on IMDb when I just scrolled a second ago. Ron Perlman actually like tore his ACL and broke his knee or something when wave hit him. Every time I watch
when he's like, so after the chase, you mean?
When he's like trying to get away from Ryan Gosling, he's walking out into the water, that giant wave hits him and knocks him over.
Right.
So then when Ryan Gosling runs over and grabs him by the lapels and it looks like he's about to drown him, I think he's actually dragging him out of the ocean so he doesn't die because he just broke his knee, which kind of screws up the way you watch the movie, but it's actually an interesting piece of trivia.
Oh my God. There's actually a lot of good trivia in here that I think is sort of telling about, let's read the internet. I don't know where this came from, but many people found this interesting. Ryan Gosling replaced Hugh Jackman.
Oh God.
He had a special thanks credit in the end of the film. And I was like, what did he have to do with this?
Did you find the trivia in there? My other favorite piece of trivia about this is he's told the story on Conan or whatever. The first time he met the director to talk about the project.
Yeah.
The director wouldn't even like look him in the eye or speak to him. And he's like, why am I here for this meeting? The director, like he liked his work. He'd previously seen it, but the guy wouldn't even look at him or speak to him. And he's like, all right, I guess the meeting's over. And Nicholas Winding Refn was like, you got to take me back to my hotel because I don't drive because I'm from France or wherever.
He failed his driving test 8 times. And most of the time they spent together was Ryan Gosling showing him around LA.
Yeah. So he's driving him back to his hotel, still haven't spoken. And then the director just starts crying to himself and then starts singing along to an REO Speedwagon song on the radio. And they both start singing along together. And he's like, you know what? This is what this movie should be about. It should be about pop music, driving around LA, and then they bonded and started talking that way. It's like,
he's your drunk friend from high school.
He's your drunk friend from high school. Then you're 3/4 of the way to dropping him back off at his mom's place.
We should promise we'll always be friends forever.
We should make this movie together. It'd be really great.
You guys.
Oh, God, the music in this movie is so good, though.
It's so perfect. It's so perfect. And it's funny because now, I have a kid who's 9, and she discovers music in the strangest ways. One of them is that she discovers things at camp. And so, like, today she came home and she has now declared that her two favorite songs are I Love Rock and Roll and Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. And so all afternoon, my daughter has been walking around the house dancing with headphones on, singing along to George and Andrew. But it's difficult. I mean, I think even maybe not so much for folks your age, but like we're like, you know, if you're of a certain vintage, you could hear something even that's a parody and know how good of a parody it is, like kind of a hot tub time machine, and go, they got this was too early, this was too late, and they wouldn't have been listening to Safety Dance in 1987. But what's funny is like how much I could locate this music as specifically being from, I'm going to say, 1983 to 1985. When in fact, it's music from the 2000s that just happens to sound very much like music from 1983 to 1985 in a movie that is totally contemporaneous. I'm always so amazed when somebody can pull off some kind of a retro vintage thing without being too cute. But like I thought, you know, between the Mistral and the, you know, Real Human Being stuff, what a soundtrack. Great stuff.
Yeah,
and some of the stuff like the Real Human Being might be a little on the nose, but just, you know, the editing cues to a lot of this stuff too, and the way that, you know, the sound editing, the way it ramps up and down volume and just stops and starts in places, it works so perfectly in so many different places. Like that opening car chase.
That's exactly the one. It's like, you know, I mean, the classic being bum, and then the scroll starts, right? And you're like, okay, after the bum 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 bum, 20th Century Fox, you hear bum, and then the scroll starts, and like that's going to give me wood for the rest of my life because that's Star Wars, and I know that cue. In this one, so you got the startup in the motel room, you got the awesome chase scene, and then I feel like it goes to black, and then it comes up on Lights of the City, and that. What is it? Night Stalking, Night Caller, whatever that song is with Night the vocoder. Oh my God. It's so dark. And like, I think that's when I probably fell for the movie is because I loved that opening sequence so much. And, you know, walking out with the baseball cap on, international symbol for I'm not who you think I am.
It just says LA on it too.
LA, but it says LA.
The song while he's driving, it's like, you know, it's like your heartbeat as you're trying to watch this sort of like, stressful scene, and it keeps getting louder and louder, and just slows down when everyone's trying to be quiet under the bridge and hide from the helicopter, and then it just ramps back up. But what one of my major gripes, which I again will totally give this movie a pass on, is sadly the driving in the opening scene. So like when they're on that bridge and the helicopter light hits his car, mm-hmm. and he stomps his foot down and the engine noise revs and blares in your ears, all of the cars are moving the same speed still on that bridge. He doesn't pass anybody. He's not moving
fast. I didn't
notice
that.
Yeah, well, you don't because, you know, the sound editing is great and there's the stress and the emotion in the scene. But as he's going over that bridge with the helicopter light on him, he's not moving fast at all, which bums me out. Like later when he's in that Mustang running from the Chrysler or whatever, that scene is actually with real fast cars doing stunt related things.
Except there's like gear noises when he's in reverse and there wouldn't be because it's only one thing. But it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I don't care.
It's okay. You're in a safe place. Now, you guys know Los Angeles. You're in the industry, Hollywood, wherever. Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Yeah.
Where are you?
Phoenix.
So, Joe, if you were going to escape from the L.A. Parking lot, would you have taken that route? Would you have found yourself stuck on a bridge? Because I'm thinking a bridge, whoo, like some kind of like a causeway. That's the getaway driver's worst enemy.
Yeah, well, he apparently was going over the 7th Street Bridge, which is that there's no cover or anything, so he's stuck there. But there is cover if he gets off and goes to where he went to Santa Fe and 7th. That part was accurate. There's sort of an overpass thing down there. Unfortunately, I think there's like a chain link fence, so you can't just like park a car down there. But it doesn't really matter for the purposes of this film. I would say this film's more truthful to the geography of LA than
anything like, that was ever shot in San Francisco ever.
Yeah.
Did you just go through a portal? Like, wait a minute. So how did you get from Embarcadero to what? Now you're on 101? What?
You fly over the hill and then you T-bone a trolley car and that's all you need to see. You got Alcatraz in the background, no matter which way you're pointing.
Banging on the wheel like Gene Hackman.
Yeah, like the movie Collateral, which was also filmed in L.A., that one they just skipped around all over the place. And that was a more recent one. But then you got the real old gems like Cobra, where all of a sudden they go from downtown to the canals of Venice. So I have no idea how they arrange that. But this film is mostly okay in that you don't necessarily see any glaring, obvious major problems with the landscape. I thought it was kind of weird, though, when he takes out Ron Perlman and he's on that cliff, and then all of a sudden it turns out that cliff was like a 20-foot little drop to some sand dunes.
That was a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah. And then there was the like lighthouse light, and I was like, where is
John,
there
John
a
Hamm
lighthouse?
Would have crawled out of that car. John Hamm would have been back two more times after that.
That lighthouse light, too, that's another one where it has that sort of like stabbing music riff going along every time the light swings around. It's just so creepy. But that scene is one of my, like, if I want to donate like a week's worth of VFX work to this movie, and that's one of them where you can see the little like ramps that the car flew off of at the top of the cliff and that shot.
Really?
Yeah, sorry to ruin all this stuff
for
you.
No, no, no. I don't see any
of it. You can see the edges
of
the ramp like right in the shot where the car flies off, and then they remove them for all the other shots where the actors are in it. But like, I just want to paint out the little like 1 foot of metal track that you can see poking out over that little bush.
CGI is ruining movies. Well, the strippers sure were calm, weren't they? Would you be that calm if someone was hammering on the guy in your dressing room?
No.
I feel like if they're owned by Nino and that doofus, they've probably seen some things, especially in there. So,
but, I mean, it feels like it would affect your art. Like, would you be able to go out there and really do your best work? She's the one lady was real calm. She had her legs crossed the whole time. She's a real lady. She seemed, very, very put together. I would find that very upsetting, especially when you get to the bullet
or something.
Sedative. That's smart. Yeah.
And that scene in particular, I think I would say, is a preview of what awaits you in Neon Demon. In that there is just gratuitous boobs out for no particular reason, and nobody seems to be moving with any speed or purpose. So they're all just hanging out. I like the hammer part of that scene.
So sudden. So sudden.
I love how he didn't even bring, it's not like a large hammer. Like, he's not like, look at the weapon I've chosen. He's just like, no, this is the tool I need to do this particular job.
No, that's no Mjolnir. That's like what he had in his trunk.
Yeah, exactly. It fit in his back pocket for his walk down there.
I have seen this movie, honestly, at least 3 times before this. I really like this movie, and I have a funny anecdote about this movie, but I have seen this several times. I did not remember how disturbingly violent this movie is. I mean, as in like really like shockingly graphically violent, but the way that they pull it off that makes it, first of all, the way the violence hits you so hard that you get this feeling of like, there's, with the exception of like, okay, now we see when Joan is in the bathroom, we see the silhouette of the guy outside. You know, there's the jingling on the door and stuff is going to go down. But a lot of it, but then when it does happen, it is so sudden and so unexpected that it really takes you off your game. There's not like a big John Woo, like slow motion thing going on. Like it happens fast.
Yeah. Also, it happens in camera. Like they are not cutting away when the shot happens, like a lot of other pictures would do. They linger on Christina Hendricks's head exploding there all over the place, and it's just like, okay, I guess we needed that shot for reasons, but wow, what a mess.
Speaking of in camera, I feel the need to chime in and say that the movie did blow its VFX budget on gore enhancement specifically.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the bathroom in particular, because it feels like, I'd love for you guys to tell me, because it feels like there were a lot of moving parts to the, how does one say, Joan's headshot.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I'm sure there was a dummy that they blew up on set. Okay. And I'm sure that dummy looked almost nothing like Christina Hendricks. And I'm sure they had Christina Hendricks stand there and act like she'd been shot. And
we
then
can't
they
afford a dimple in the chin.
Then they put the two things together.
Unfortunately, Ryan Gosling has grown a mustache.
Like a Blade Runner style, like, well, that's a man in a raincoat. That's not right. Did you guys ever see that? Do you remember that from Blade Runner? Breaking through the glass, the snake lady gets shot, and like you can, they fixed it starting. Did they fix it in 99? I know they fixed it in one of them, one of the redos, but like, you know, once you saw it on a big screen, you're like, oh my gosh, that's totally a man in a raincoat. That doesn't look like that lady at all.
I thought man in a raincoat was a euphemism.
Yeah. I was like, I haven't heard the mustache style before, but, handlebars.
Yeah, they call it cottaging. let's see, other, so there was that, I thought that whole, that scene was pretty great. Boy, he got pretty lucky, in the, motel. But that was really, that's a fun sequence because it's real shocking. It's fun to watch a character realize something. Like, you got to love the moment in a movie when somebody realizes that something is a setup. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, plus, I think part of the reason everything else works so well is because the violence is so shocking. Like, you need to see this world that he's kind of, you know, he wishes he could give up, and the part of his personality that he wishes didn't exist, in order to understand why he would try and, you know, finagle his way into Carey Mulligan's life. Because, you know, it's certainly a much better life than jamming a curtain rod into some guy's neck because they double crossed you on a money
grab. Oh my god, it's not enough that you just like pulverize this guy's face. You have to pull down like some window dressing and go to town on him. Oh my god. Mm-hmm. The elevator scene also, just talk about, I think it might have gotten an award for sound editing. I thought the sound, you guys tell me, but I thought the sound in this was really, really nicely done.
I would agree. The crunch,
that's a squishy,
was
squishy elevator kicks.
There's squish and there's also crunch, because that's when you know that he's like caved in his head.
That's when you're getting the heel into it.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've watched this movie with my my big movie editing headphones on, and boy, did that really sell.
Ooh.
Yeah.
No. But also, I think that scene is one of the ones that has a lot of the CG.
I don't know if I would have gone for the long kiss in the elevator.
No.
But the guy that you know has a gun, that didn't completely work for me.
Also,
the putting his hand back to gently move her aside, I thought was already a little bit of a stretch, but I was bought in. But then the turning around and the kiss was a little bit of a bridge too far for me.
Yeah, because he can't see the person he's against. But more importantly,
I will fight you on that if you want. The movie is unclear about how far their sort of like flirtatious high school relationship has gone at this point. I personally don't think that they've really, I don't know that he's actually kissed her at any point in this movie up until now.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you guys were talking earlier about quote unquote affair, I don't think consummate would be way too strong a word. I bet they hadn't even kissed by the Star Wars showed up. Yeah.
I think he knew his time was up, especially when he saw that gun, that this is basically going to be like, we're running out of time here, because she's clearly not down with the plan of fleeing town with $1 million. So he's basically going to say, like, you know, he's taking the opportunity to, you know, it's the high point of their relationship right here, right before it comes crashing down, because he's about to crush some guy's skull with his foot.
I guess
it was literally then or never. He was never going to get that opportunity to kiss her.
I mean, still, there's consent that might be involved, especially since she had just slapped him right before this, when they're discussing how he had been involved with the death of her husband. I think it's a little much for him to assume that he needed to kiss her. But like you're saying, maybe he just didn't care at that point and just wanted to make sure that he kissed her before he thought he might die.
It's also an unspoken. He's saying, like, you know, trust me, I really love you and care about you, and what I'm about to do is for a reason, and I'm sorry, but I have to do this. But just know that I really do care about you, seriously.
Well, what's really unspoken is the unmotivated lighting change that happens when the slow-mo kicks in that elevator, and I really...
Perhaps you have not seen the video, Every Frame of Painting, because what separates Edgar Wright is the ability to do a dramatic lighting cue.
Don't the lights dim when you're in love and you have a passionate kiss, Joe?
Yeah, just for a second at least, for sure. You guys probably know this from my internet presence. I'm a woke Twitter ally. And I think for me, the next time, the fourth and a half, or whatever this will be, the fifth and a half time, I really want to watch this movie again. Really watch it from Irene's point of view, because I think this is a different movie if you imagine this as Irene's movie. You know what I mean? If you really want to help her out, go away. You know, like, you know, he wants to be loved and he's going to take these people down with him as a result. I don't be a karma suck about it. But like, I think if I were to go back and rewatch this absolutely from Irene's point of view and knowing what her concerns are, you know, and you know, this is the, again, back to the sophomore in college problem. The sophomore in college problem is that, like, as a straight man in college, I had very little nuance or understanding about what a woman might potentially want out of a relationship. And then it's so much more complicated than what I wanted, which was just unmitigated love and petting. And, you know, the thing is, like, when you meet somebody and like her needs are certainly very complex. I think the last thing that Irene legitimately wanted was a very serious relationship with somebody, especially somebody who could be bad news, that she's got a lot to keep wired together. And maybe what she wanted was like flirtation, offering a glass of water, toothpick boy likes my son. That's nice. But like, I have a feeling if I rewatch this, I don't want to belabor it, but I have a feeling if I rewatch this from her point of view, he would not feel quite so heroic to me.
No, and you can definitely see she doesn't feel that way about him in their last scene together when she gets off that elevator and she's just staring at him like he's some monster as the door slowly closes and separates the two of them. Like, she doesn't want anything to do with him in this way. And before, she thought he was a nice guy before she knew all this other stuff that he just kicked in people's heads in the elevator. But, you know, and was involved in the death of her husband. She didn't know that he was doing anything illegal. On the side, he just said, "Oh, I'm a driver. I drive." Mm-hmm. To her, he seemed harmless and benign, and like a good person, especially for Benicio to be around when his own father was absent.
She would probably, I mean, like a lot of single parents or single, you know, yeah, single parents, like you wouldn't mind having a good example of the not extant home sex to be there, to model well for somebody and to be right, strong but gentle kind of person in her life.
Yeah, he's yeah, calm and sort of simple, and he has a simple job, but he's gentlemanly. He offered to help with the car and carry the groceries, that sort of thing. I mean, she's not looking for adventure in her life. She's looking for a stable person to be a decent example for her son while her ex-husband or whatever, or current husband, is in jail. Like, yeah, it's exactly the opposite of Stanford is what she thought she had. And then when she saw that elevator scene, you know, her entire illusion of what he could have been or what he was completely shattered. And that's right. Her heartbreak. It's not just anger that he contributed to the death of Oscar Isaac, because yeah, that's sad, but you know, Oscar Isaac was in with some bad people and she knew that already. But like, not only that, but she lost the dream of this simple guy who was being nice to her, and now she's back to where she was at the beginning of the movie.
Also, I mean, I think it's a nice note was that, I don't know if this is not particularly deep, but so like he's sitting like kind of over by the windowsill in his t-shirt, and they've had their day together. They've driven down that Chinatown River, like they've done all their stuff. And then her report card on the day was basically he had a good time. You know what I mean? And I thought that was, I think that's what she would say, which partly as a way to say I had a good time, but also as a way to say, telegraphing, like, this is important to me, that like, you know, he absolutely is my priority. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love their relationship. I mean, as, you know, whatever, it's a fucking Hollywood movie, who cares? But like, I love the relationship between the two of them, whether it's like, like, you know, I think it would have been easy to say like, okay, Ryan, now here's the thing, like, you're going to turn out to be a great dad, and you're going to be fun, and you know how to make things out of napkins that would be amusing. Instead, he's like, you want a toothpick? Like, I love that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think one of the most telling scenes about the relationship, too, is when she gets the phone call about Oscar Isaac coming home from prison. Like, when they're in the car, he's just looking over at her, not saying anything. And she absolutely doesn't want to say it, but she has to say it. And then she does. And then you can see on her face that she both wants to cry and then both, you know, say 100 different things about like, I'm so sorry, I never meant to get this far or whatever. I know we both have feelings, right, and this and that, blah, blah, blah. But it's basically just like, you know, she can't. All she can do is sit there and be sad, and they're both sad. And that's just what adults have to do in that situation, apparently.
Yeah. And then there's the welcome home party. Where
that's so good.
She's not enjoying that party. Any part, yeah, of that party, even the part where Oscar Isaac is apologizing and saying how he's going to do
like
better
the first
for his
episode,
family.
It's like the first episode of The Wire when what's his name gets out of jail and it's like, yeah, you're out of jail. And like, we're going to have a big party at the church or whatever. But like, you know, I see. But the thing is also like when you become a grown up and you have stuff to do, like your emotions become so much more complex because the emotion that it is not entirely acceptable to say when something terrible happens is, oh shit, more stuff. Like, here's another, you know what I mean? It's, she's supposed to be, in any other movie, she'd be like, she's either supposed to be like, oh my God, my abusive criminal husband is getting out of jail. Or she's, whatever, you know what I mean? I'm not saying he's abusive, but, or it's the whole like, oh yay, it's going to be like one of those 70s paintings of the bikers going to meet the guy coming out of prison. And
yeah,
it's going to be all.
Yeah, Benicio was so young when he went in that now, as soon as he's out, we're going to put roses in our hair and go renew our vows so we can be
absolutely
a family again. It's like,
the,
no.
It's really, it's like Fast and the Furious. It's really about family. Never seen any of the movies. But, you know, that's the thing is, like, she just doesn't, she probably just doesn't want a bunch of bullshit in her life. But, you know, here's another, just in passing, it occurs to me that, like, you think about, I think we've stipulated that the antagonists in this, Bernie and Nino, I mean, Bernie's not a careless man, and Nino's not an idiot, but both of them will strike out. The thing with Driver, what do we call him, Drive Boy? The thing with Drive Boy is that, like, he's ultimately extremely conservative in almost everything that he does. And I think that's part of what, it's not an obvious note to hit, but what comes out is that he's almost, this is, again, one of those genre movies where, like, it's amazing how many genre movies, somewhere in them, also have a little bit of Western. And this definitely has a lot of Western, you know, Western themes in it. Where, like, in this case, the Western part of it is, like, you know, he thinks a lot about what he's doing. He's a professional. He has rules. He has an ethos, if you like. And he does not want to do anything that puts himself, in particular, at risk. So he is very deliberative. Like, think about, I love the whole, like, run-up to, from the scene in the garage, after Standard gets, you know, beat up until that scene in the bathroom about, like, how much money he owes. And I feel like Gosling does a nice job of, like, you can really see he's really processing this. He's really looking through the angles on this. It's not because he's a dumb guy. It's because he's seen a lot of this stuff go. And, like, he knows he's going to have to expose himself in a way he normally wouldn't. And I think that's very effective in building his character, is that he is ultimately conservative and not wanting to do anything risky, you know, especially if it's not necessary.
Because if he does, he potentially exposes himself and people that he may or may not care about. But at the same time, he also knows that it's going to make him fly off the handle. Like, you know, if he has to strike back, he's going to do it hard. And he probably doesn't exactly like stomping guys' skulls in, but that's what he's going to have to do. And he's so conservative to the point that he has his horrible little apartment full of like one bag full of stuff where he sits with a lamp and pretends to fix a carburetor.
And then his sister comes in and makes fun of him for having a stool. Wait a minute, different movie. I agree. And it's also that, you know, how do you put this? You know, this is one way in which I think it is very similar to Baby Driver, where in a way that I like, which is that, like, you know, this is a profession for me. Like, this is a thing that I do. And I think actually in Baby Driver, that's, without spoiling it, that's well portrayed in that scene in the diner where Jamie Foxx is basically tearing down that couple about who they really are. You know, what's his line that, you know, like, you rob to afford drugs, and I whatever do drugs to rob or something like that. And like in this case, Ryan Gosling, I think he sees this as, like, this is the thing that he does. This is a profession. And not only just for his safety, but, like, you know, as with Baby Driver and the Kevin Spacey character in the other movie, like, they want to be surrounded by professionals. And they know that it really only takes one bozo making one dumb mistake for this thing to go totally tits up. And, like, I cannot afford that. Like, there's a reason I put my goddamn watch on the spoke of the steering wheel. And it's because this is how I survived. That 5 minutes is how I survived. You knowing how serious I am about that 5 minutes, I am worth being that picky about, because I will get you out of the situation, but you need to follow my rules.
Yeah, he's got his rules and people have to abide by them or he's not into it. He's like the Merlin Man of driving.
I'm not busy. I'm time constrained.
No, but I love that scene in the diner where he's eating his pie and drinking his coffee and that guy comes up to him and he's like, hey, remember me? We did a job together. And he's like, seriously, get away from me. I'm going to kill you.
So good. So good.
It's like, you need to stop talking because you're making this worse for all of us. Somebody could hear, and that's not good. And not only that, like, we had an agreement. I don't ever want to see you again. I helped you out. You gave me some money. That's it.
Yeah, like, this isn't the exercise yard. We don't talk about this. Like, what are you doing? Like, just don't talk about crime. Don't talk. Stop doing that. Are we missing anything else big in this? Ooh, that creepy mask. Ooh, that mask was creepy.
That was a very creepy mask. Because he was supposed to theoretically be the stunt double for, like, I don't know, Jason Statham or something. And so they,
yeah,
they
you
had
see
this...
the guy very briefly in the mirror there.
Right,
he's just
right.
An old
Why
guy
is
with
Hollywood
the
star Jason Statham hurting Vincent from Beauty and the Beast?
Nobody.
And yes, I did change my Skype icon just for you guys.
Yeah, that's terrifying, by the way. I noticed that.
Do you remember when
talking...
that show was popular? Do you remember that? Were you too young then? You were probably kids then.
I'm pretty sure I remember it. I didn't have any context for it. And it was just, it's, yeah, it's in my memory.
Well, that's one of those shows. Beauty and the Beast is one of those shows. It was in, I was in college when it came out. And like when you're, in, at least for me, when I was in college, there was like the 3, 2, 5 shows that I never missed. Like Twin Peaks and Pee Wee's Playhouse and Mighty Mouse. And there was everything else. Like I utterly missed Star Trek, Next Generation or whatever. Totally missed that because it was just off the radar screen. And it's so strange. It was really a nice hint of what it would be like to be an old man. It was just be like, oh, wait a minute. There's a monster man who lives in a sewer and like this lady's in love with him and it's a romance and it's like, ooh. But I like that actor a lot. Ron Perlman, I have enjoyed him in many, many things. I like what that guy brings to a movie.
Yeah. I mean, he's not always in good movies, but he does a good job in every movie
he's
in. He
might as well
in.
Be English, you know? Yeah. He'll take the role.
Yeah. I mean, he's in also a wide variety of roles. Makeup, no makeup, easygoing guy, evil yeah. villain, whatever. Like, he'll
what
do
voice.
Anything.
What a voice.
Yeah.
What yeah, he's the Hellboy. He's got his red thing going on,
he's
too.
He's the Hellboy. I got to watch that again.
Yeah. And then he has the Pacific Rim thing and stuff. And he's in.
I like that movie.
He's in Alien people Resurrection for some reason.
People don't like that movie. I like that movie. Why did that movie. You guys, why did Pacific Rim not succeed? It is okay to answer because it was bad. But why didn't that movie succeed?
Because it was bad.
Okay. Bad.
Dan, do you have any? Okay. All right.
I saw that particular movie with your friend Sandy, and the next day I said, "What'd you think of the movie?" He's like, "I even forgot we saw a movie yesterday."
He's very busy.
See, with that one, how should I put this? I wouldn't have had a problem with many of the excesses of the film, like the kaiju and the Jaegers and beating up things and stuff. Like that's all fine. I just thought the writing was just bad.
Well, and the big Hero 6 ending was a little silly.
Yeah. And you had your we can't afford the guy who plays Thor as your main actor. It was kind of boring.
Oh, I think he's from the program with Hellboy.
Oh.
Yeah, the Sons of Anarchies.
Charles Hunnam. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, let me ask you this. This is a random one. Have you guys seen Edge of Tomorrow?
Yes.
Yes.
Have you seen that, Joe?
Yeah. I liked it.
Did you do it? Have you guys flopped it?
We did.
We have flopped it, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll go back and listen. I guess I've forgotten that.
It's of no concern. I was reluctant to do it for a very long time. I had heard that it was very good. I had heard some stories about people who were working on it, who were working very long hours and were very upset. And it was one of those projects that had a sort of troubled production history.
Also, Joe hates Tom Cruise.
I hate him so much.
I get that. I have actors like that.
Yeah. I see him like being Tom Cruise in a role and it just makes me angry. Like it totally throws me out of the film. Cause he's just so associated with like Going Clear and a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's just like, I can't picture you like get off of Oprah's couch. I can't take that stuff out of the film that I'm trying to watch right now.
Yeah. Ever since that one video leaked, it's been hard, even knowing what we've known. That one video of, well, we shouldn't say cut this out, but the one that's from the big, did you ever see the very long video of the summit hosted by David Miscavige? With him in it, not just the one where he talks about how they're going to take over the world and he like gets like crazy eyes. Have you ever seen any of those, the very long ones where they talk about all the tech and all that stuff? Have you ever seen any of those?
I've never watched any of the videos. I've only seen the excerpts that they put into the Going Clear documentary thing.
If you watch more than about 20 minutes without taking a break, you will feel insane. Wow. Like, you know how even if you watch the documentaries about that, you're like, oh my God, this is so dark. I already feel insane. It's like that's like that hyper-normalization movie. Like, I don't even know what's real anymore. So, yeah, he can be a turnoff, but it's got that lady I like. She was good as the ninja woman, and I thought that was a fun movie.
Yeah, no, she's fantastic. Emily Blunt. I love her in Devil Wears Prada.
She's Sicario, right? Is that her?
Yeah.
Or yeah. Is she Black Hawk Down? Who is she? She's Sicario. No,
she's Captain Sicario from Sicario.
Captain Sicario.
That's a good movie.
What else did I have in notes? My notes are really minimal. Did you ever see Blink? You ever seen that Doctor Who episode, Blink?
I have. Dan hasn't, because Dan hates things. He also hasn't seen the episode with Albert Brooks in The Simpsons, Scorpio. So.
Oh, that's so good. He's kind of like David Branson, sort of.
Yeah. Oh, I think it was Richard Branson, right?
Like, what did I say? David Branson?
Yes.
I think that one's he's the 10th Doctor.
he flips
his scarf. We're all made of stars.
Yeah, no, that's a fun one where it's sort of like a Bond episode at one point.
I could think of, like, he's had so many, at least two great roles on there that I could think of. The other one was when he's Jacques, the bowling instructor.
Yeah, and then he...
Come with me, Marge, away from Barney's Bolarama and the clatter of pins. Two onion rings! Simpsons is funny. What else are we leaving out? Echo Park. Is that where Sandy used to live? Didn't he used to live near there? He was in Low Something, right?
Well, he was in a place with a very long name that I didn't know how to pronounce. Now he's somewhere else.
Yeah, I figured.
He's
the David Branson now, right?
Yeah.
And we're all made of sandwiches.
He can't go out to a bar anymore without his ads popping up all over the place.
Every goddamn hotel room.
Mr. Truestar.
Amazing. He's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially if you know the videos that he's not in that he did.
Oh, is that right?
There's a lot of them, yeah.
Mm. Love that guy. Mm. Mm-hmm. Anything else that we're forgetting? Love the music.
Yeah. So Christina Hendricks is in here for a very brief period of time.
Jane does not get a lot to do in this.
No, I was actually kind of surprised. I saw her. I was just like, oh, this is an interesting wrinkle, adding her to this. Let's see where it goes. And it's like, oh, she's here for 5 minutes, and then she's gone.
If you told me that she had laryngitis for the 2 days she was on set, I would totally believe it. Now, is this before Mad Men?
No, it was during. Oh.
It's just totally after Mad Men, or like during Mad Men.
Yeah, apparently, according to Wikipedia, this was originally supposed to be a porn star, and the director had interviewed several to screen them and see who could do it, but none of them really had the acting chops. Go figure. And then he was like, you know what? Let's cast Christina Hendricks.
According to IMDb, his wife recommended her.
That's good. Good job.
I don't know who vets this stuff.
No. Mm. I mean, I have no idea. This could all be fake news.
I would like to meet Nicholas Winding Refn's wife, because he is a very strange man.
He always looks surprised.
He always has like a sweater kind of like tied around his waist, like he peed his pants at recess and didn't have a spare with him or something.
Oh, that's
Have you ever
sucks.
Seen the behind the scenes stuff?
No, he's a sweater boy. I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, look at that.
Just always seems like a startled turtle.
It's like a young Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions.
Yeah, he did an episode of that soundtracking podcast where he talks about the movies of all his films. Most of it is, unfortunately, about Neon Demon that you hate there, Joe.
Oh, the music's good.
He does talk about his other movies.
I got that off the internet, and I never watched it.
But, it's on Amazon if you got the Prime.
And it's free.
I got the Prime. I don't have the Dingus. My Dingus is away. I got to bring my Dingus back up.
Hmm.
You know, I ran out of ports is the thing, and now I'm having to swap. I don't like port swapping.
Terrible.
Can you get a hub? Or you're maxed out on
hubs,
aren't you?
I should get a hub. You know what's funny? Like, everybody's buying the TV that I've been looking at for a year. Everybody's buying that OLED.
LG?
Yeah, and it was a Stu bought one, and Marco bought one. It's the one I've been looking at for like a really long time, and I don't know why you can't just put 6 ports on. Well, yeah, who doesn't? If you're going to buy a TV like that, why not put 6 ports on there? It's not, I mean, it sounds fancy, but like if you have a couple consoles and some set-top boxes, like you just fill that thing right up. It's nuts.
Yeah. I got my HD DVD player and my Blu-ray player still plugged in.
Wow. That is dedication.
I haven't turned either of them on in years, so I don't know if they still work.
But. We bought a Blu-ray player for like $18, but I just used the PlayStation, but it's like each time it's just like, oh yeah, right.
Firmware update. Some features of this disc may not work.
Right. And like, here's some features that are also available. Oh, it's so bad.
Did you know that you could have a customer service rep in a picture-in-picture window while you're watching the movie in case you have any questions?
Oh my god, like, I want three buttons. Like I realize I'm one of those very simple men who's used to just using an Apple TV, but like my goodness, how many different ways can you use the word menu? Like, I want to get to a thing called menu where I get to select things with one button. And then I can go left and right. And you know what? How about this? Let's not have anything cute. First of all, as my friend John Syracuse and I have talked about, don't show me anything about what happens in the movie on any of the screens. And then don't have like a cute menu. No cute menus. It shouldn't look like a Nicolas Cage scroll. You know, it shouldn't be something where like when you flip through, it changes to a postage stamp at behind the button you're on. And it's the
worst.
Well,
see, you've got your top menu and then you've got your pop-up menu.
You know, that's what it is. You got top menu, you got pop-up menu. Oh, that's a good point.
And now they can put CSS on the pop-up menu so it can be themed to match the movie.
I'll tell you, that feels pretty good to be watching your Fantastic Mr. Fox using a PlayStation 4 controller. That feels good. Beep boop, zeep zorp.
These days, I don't want to use anything that I can't just shout words at the remote and have something show up on my screen.
It's so weird that is the quickest way to get to anything. We were doing that today. And, you know, my daughter already pretty much refuses to type on the iPad. She does everything with dictation. And now we've gotten good at find Wake Me Up Before You Go Wham on YouTube. And that's so much easier than searching on YouTube. I wish they put Hulu. This is not part of the show. I wish they put Hulu into the mix on Siri. I think it is not. The Hulu interface is bad. The service is good, and the app is bad. Very bad.
I think they seem... I don't subscribe, but it seems that people are generally objecting to the whole overall redesign that they did when they added the right. live...
The
DVR
giant cards.
And everything. Yeah,
the giant cards, but also just like there's no sense that you are paying any attention to what I'm doing. Where like, you know, bad on me, a lot of what I watch is CNN and MSNBC. And for whatever reason, when I'm on one, the other channel is almost always at the exact other end. So if you're using the live, what's it called, the flipboard thing where you can like flip while you're watching a show, it's almost always like all the way to the other end. Or you can go to my channels where you put your bespoke channels, or you can go to, it's so random, like the way it's put together. It's not made to actually use any way like you would use like a cable clicker. It's the worst.
I get that on my watch now too, now that they added the recents thing to the dock, because I'll be in something and then I'll accidentally hit something else, and then I'll be on the last card, which is recents, and of course my most important things are all the way at the beginning. But I'm still angry at Siri, because like most of the things I use are like play up, you know, just resume playing whatever you was, whether it was music or something. And I just discovered you can't say play at full volume in a single command, because it'll say you're not playing anything. You have to say play and then trigger it again and say turn the volume all the way up. And it's like, you really can't parse those two things together at the same time.
I run into that all the time with my Amazon product, where it's frequently, hey Dingus, play KQED. And then it'll be like, you know, hey Dingus, volume 4 or volume 8, volume 7, whatever. You know what I mean? And it's like, you really feel like an animal, like having to execute those commands like that. It's silly. But, you know, I think it'll get there. I think a lot of this stuff will get there.
Yeah. And we really just need to be using Siri for our to-do lists, like The Rock, and then, you know.
I haven't watched that yet. I heard it's not good.
It's amusing enough for whatever 3 minutes or whatever it is. But
well, give it the Ebert test. Did it succeed at what you think it was trying to do?
It's right up there with the Zooey Deschanel dancing around while it's raining and talking to Siri commercial for me.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, it's
America's sweetheart.
Yeah, she has glasses and bangs and stuff.
Yeah, she sure does.
I hear she's friends with your friend.
Broke his heart. What else have we got in this one?
I think that's it.
I think we covered it. Yeah.
We covered the film. I mean,
did anyone else notice the camera reflection in the car window? It's just me.
No, totally didn't.
No.
When he sets the bags down on top of his car and walks over to Irene the first time, he helps her out when her car's broken. As the camera's coming around him, it's just like, oh, look, there's a big Arri Alexa with a trash bag over it because it's raining in his car window.
No. I noticed is that in that same scene, he has a paper bag of groceries that he takes to his car, then turns over and notices her. And then he takes her up to the apartment and he's got two bags and he leaves both of the bags there. So where did his bag with his groceries go?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Continuity issues. There's another continuity issue.
Well, and there's a little bit of empty coffee cup when he's carrying his bags out to the car. There's a little bit of like, I don't think there's anything in those bags.
They're very crisp corners on those bags.
Super crisp, almost like a box.
Yeah. One of the continuity errors that I took me a couple viewings to notice, but I really don't care anymore, is like after they have their first outing at the disgusting river and Benicio's wearing his jacket or whatever, later on, like in the next couple of scenes when they're finally having their little montage of high school love, there's a shot where he lays Benicio down in bed wearing the jacket, which was clearly shot from that first interaction because he's wearing the same outfit he was wearing from the first time. But that shot worked better in the montage where they're actually getting to know each other because he's leaning up against the door jamb in the kid's room, which he wouldn't have done the first time because he's over there sitting by the windowsill because he doesn't know these people yet.
Yeah. And there's stuff where,
see,
like,
this is the way editors can make movies work nicely.
And there's stuff where in the scenes where he's fixing the cars and they have flopped
the
footage.
Oh, he doesn't know anything about how to, he doesn't know how to fix cars at all.
Yeah, no. But they flopped the footage, so his hair parts is on the wrong side.
What? Really?
Yeah. It doesn't matter. None of these things matter.
I didn't see that one.
Dang.
None of these things matter. It's just one of those things you notice when you're watching it. But that's how you make a movie in editing, folks, is you just take a bunch of stuff and then you just flip it and flop it and retime it and then just squeeze it all together. You get a movie.
You get a blessing and a curse. Ratcheting screwdriver, and then you just keep cranking on a carburetor until
Zika,
it's done.
Zika, 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 Zika.
I have that little screwdriver. It came in like a free pack with something else.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Husky.
No judgment. All right, so that wraps it up. Thank you, Merlin, for being here.
Oh, thank you, guys. Anytime. I really enjoyed it. Now maybe I'll find it in me to go back and listen to the rest. And listen, if you were to, just for the sake of argument, get a copy of the 1978 movie The Driver, just saying, if you guys need a fill-in episode in the future, it could be a thing we do.
We'll keep that in the
carport.
Will
you take it under consideration?
We'll put it in the parking lot.
We'll take it under consideration. Joe likes themed series of movies, so while we're talking about Getaway Drivers, I mean, it's prudent to investigate.
I'm zipping it up right now. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.